Okay, so we're recording. So welcome everyone to the next edition of the Paragon podcast. You're here with myself, Chris Linney, and also here with Debbie Hyman. We are part of the cardiology team here at Paragon. And our podcast is, on this occasion for you, is the cardiac medications, can you do harm? So it's a question we get asked a lot, is if we give the medications because we think a patient's in heart failure, but we don't do any of the diagnostics, what harm can we do? And actually, there are some times where the medications that we would give ordinarily to our heart failure patients may be detrimental. So we're planning to run through the four most common drugs that we use. That includes the diuretics. Everyone's familiar with furosemide, but occasionally we may use others. We'll be talking about pimobendan, and we'll be talking about ACE inhibitors and spironolactone as well. Mostly going to focus on the side effects we see with the medications, the potential for interactions with other conditions in the body and other types of drugs as well, and when it might be severely contraindicated to give these medications as well.
Great. Thanks, Chris, for that lovely introduction. So I think the most common things that we want to know about is side effects and the drugs. So I will start with that, really. Side effects of the furosemide, what would you say is our common?
Yeah, so I think when we're thinking about furosemide, it should be the top of the treatment list for a patient with congestive heart failure. So if we're thinking about pulmonary edema, we should be going in with furosemide. And if you have a clinical suspicion of congestive heart failure, ideally we'd want to try and prove it with either a chest radiograph or potentially looking for B-lines. But if you don't have those facilities and you have a very strong index of suspicion, the only time that we'd be a bit more cautious is if we were suspicious of a pericardial effusion. So if the dog presents with muffled heart sounds and potentially ascites, if they present with weak pulses, that may be a patient that we don't want to give furosemide to without doing more diagnostics. But say, for example, it's your 10-year-old dog that's had a gradual onset of murmur over several years, it presents with dyspnea and tachypnea, and you listen to the chest and it's all crackly, it would be reasonable to consider a one-off dose of furosemide. But there are side effects that we should be aware of if we were to do that. And mainly, if we give furosemide to a patient, we're going to reduce their electrolyte, we're going to cause them to expel electrolytes in their urine. So they may become hypokalemic, they may become hyponatremic, and they can also become hypochloremic, because the furosemide works on a sort of a transporter in the kidney that affects both your potassium, sodium, and chloride reabsorption. And with loss of the water, you lose those electrolytes as well. So too much furosemide in a patient that doesn't need it and is not volume overloaded may cause you to get electrolyte depletions. Again, you may also see volume depletion. And if you give a patient that doesn't have congestive heart failure and an increased circulating volume furosemide, you're going to dehydrate them and prune them out. And in some cases, if you give too much furosemide, you can actually make patients that don't have heart failure feel a lot more worse and a bit more rotten, just because they're hypovolemic. And finally, you know, we also have to be mindful of the kidneys, and there's the risk of azotemia as well. Importantly, we medicate a cat with furosemide. The other important consideration is that cats tend to be a bit more sensitive to furosemide. So we're perhaps a bit more sensitive with the dose of furosemide than we would be with other animals.
Yeah, of course. Also, there's another side effect that's not commonly known, is that ototoxicity can occur in cats with high doses of furosemide.
You know, it's funny you say that. I had a cavalier once where the owner swears, I mean, it is a cavalier, and we see deaf cavaliers all the time, but actually cavalier that seemed to become deaf after starting furosemide. But it is reported in as a human, very common side effect in humans as well.
Yeah. And I guess there's also calcium and magnesium losses as well. And one of the things I'm always concerned about is if you suddenly get an arrhythmia after treatment, you know, is there a loss of calcium or magnesium, which may potentiate arrhythmias?
Yeah.
And then there's various other things, like just warning the clients about drinking excessively and urinating, because not all clients are aware of that, and they get quite surprised when the animals start urinating in the house.
True. I think the PUPD is probably the biggest, apart from actually to give the medications, the PUPD is the biggest, you know, problem for a patient on these medications as well. I guess partly we're thinking about giving furosemide is often why I might give the evening dose as early as like 6 or 7 p.m. so the dogs have had a chance to kind of get out, have a wee before bedtime, and hopefully stay dry overnight. But in that beginning kind of week or so of starting furosemide, it's not uncommon that the dogs will be getting the owners up to go to the toilet overnight.
And one of the other things I also found was that if your sodium levels drop too significantly, that can also affect the brain. The brain's extremely sensitive to sodium fluctuations. So if you start to see an animal that's suddenly very altered with imitation and even can go as far as having seizures, that might be a case of checking those electrolytes if they are.
Yeah. I think you have to be giving pretty hefty doses to get that. So I think, you know, we're going for our standard doses of like 1 to 2 mg per kilo, and we're giving that orally. We shouldn't really see such a big sodium depletion. But I think if you're going IV and you're going hard with it, then we've got to be a bit careful and mindful that we must keep an eye on the electrolytes for sure. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, so we're talking about the precautions. So how would you approach a case then, just to minimise taking extra precautions on these cases?
In an ideal world, you know, and I appreciate that ideal worlds are not always possible, but if we can, I'd love to have baseline bloods before I start furosemide. It's so that I know that when that patient has been rescued from the pulmonary edema, we knew what they were before they started, because as soon as we give them furosemide, we are going to reduce the flow to the kidneys. We're going to reduce the preload, and we may see a pre-renal azotemia as a result. And if we don't have the bloods from beforehand, we may miscalculate that as being a renal injury, when it may have been that this dog is just a pre-renal azotemia. But equally, if we knew the dog already had kidney issues, we may be a bit more sensitive in the doses that we give as well. So ideally, I'd check renal bloods and electrolytes, have a baseline PCV as well. If we can, we would sort of assess blood pressure in case the dogs were hypotensive, because managing hypertension would also help these patients when they're in heart failure as well. And if we have started diuretics, we usually, with most diuretics, whether it be tirasemide or furosemide, will be wanting to review those electrolytes and those renal values within the first week on treatment, in an ideal world. That said, if the owners can't afford it and you're able to get them to measure appetite, food intake, urination, then I think it's a reasonable alternative if they can't afford to do it. But it's going to be more limited care, because we're going to be acting more on a reactive basis rather than proactively changing things, because we know what's up with the kidneys.
And azotemia is going to be inevitable when you're using diuretics, but when do you actually start to worry about these levels?
I see a lot of dogs that when we start the diuretics, particularly when we're thinking about the loop diuretics like furosemide and tirasemide, we often will see an increase in urea, and I think that's to be expected and not to be confused with a renal injury. So a pre-renal azotemia is very common, where you may get an elevation of urea but without the elevation in creatinine. But we tend to look at it that if you have more than a 30% increase in your renal values from baseline, then that is more likely to be an indicator of like an acute kidney injury, probably related to the diuretic therapy, in which case we then need to be a bit more a bit judicious with the dose and dose reduce to try and help save the kidney function there as well.
Great. Yeah, that's very helpful. And are there any other precautions that we need to look at when we start approaching heart failure?
I know what you mean. So like my biggest thing would be making sure that when we give the furosemide, we reduce to the lowest effective dose. It gives us something in reserve, something in the bank for when they go back into more advanced heart failure, which, you know, if a patient is doing well with congestive heart failure, we do expect them to have relapses as the condition progresses. So if we can have them on the lowest effective dose to start with, that means we've got somewhere to go in the future. But actually, if you give too much furosemide and you keep them on a high dose, that will actually activate the body to kind of progress and rapidly change heart failure. So the more volume that you lose, the more activation of the RAS system that you have, and the more activation of the RAS system you have, the more quickly heart failure may develop. So I think it's important that we go to the lowest effective dose, and that might be that you get them down to 1 mg per kg BID, sometimes even less than that as well. But we typically would start most of our patients, you know, forgetting if, you know, accounting for that they haven't got renal disease, most dogs will go home on 2 mg per kg twice a day. The cats, depending on how severe they are, they might be on 1 mg per kg, sometimes 2 mg per kg twice a day. But we want to kind of de-escalate the dose as soon as possible. And it's partly because when we get to kind of around about 9 mg per kilo per day of furosemide, that's considered to be the time which we should be thinking about diuretic resistance is coming in. And some people even use lower than that, but I think that's a reasonable number because it makes it simple in my head, at least, that you can go 3 mg/kg 3 times per day, and that's your 9 mg/kg/day. So if I've got to that kind of dose, I then will swap them over to tirasemide at that particular point. And for me, if you give more furosemide than you need, you're going to kind of encourage more resistance more quickly as well.
Interesting. So how can you tell if there is any the ceiling effect on the heart? What are there any signs that you can monitor for to know, is other than it's just refractory and you're not getting anywhere with higher dose?
Yeah, it's tricky. I think when you're trying to monitor for reaching a ceiling level, we'd often kind of look at your urine output, which I think is quite easy to do if you've got an animal catheterized, but in reality I think it's a really tricky thing to do if you're not catching the urine sample. And I must be honest and hold my hand up and say I have never done it. So I think the main thing that I would do is, if I have escalated a dose and it's had very little effect or very minimal effect for a very short space of time, I'm starting to think that those animals are becoming resistant to the diuretic that I'm giving, and I might then adjust it. Equally, if I think I've reached it very quickly, like if I have a dog where we've escalated the dose very quickly, I often go back to my initial diagnosis and think, did I diagnose or was the diagnosis correct at the very beginning? So when we made that diagnosis of congestive heart failure, did we identify a big left atrium? Did we identify the presence of B-lines on ultrasound or pulmonary edema on radiography? Because I think if you haven't got those two things, it's maybe that the diagnosis wasn't correct at the beginning. So I think that's really important to make sure you have got the right diagnosis at the very start. And I mean, in our clinic here, we do a lot of TFAST in that very acute stage when they come in. So all we want to know on admission is, how big is the left atrium? Do they have B lines? And then we might start considering furosemide at that point. But if it's a bit of an odd case, if there's like a cough that's in there as well, anything that doesn't just fit with the potential for pulmonary edema, then we should be radiographing those patients as well. You know, it's not uncommon that you uncover a comorbidity on the radiographs that you wouldn't have necessarily seen on a TFAST.
Yeah. And of course, just to mention, non-cardiogenic pulmonary edema, they don't tend to respond to diuretics, as far as in my experience.
Yeah, true. So like the dogs that come in and they've, you know, maybe like a brachycephalic that's had an airway obstruction, it's been outside on a hot day, you can radiograph those dogs and see them full of pulmonary edema, but it's non-cardiogenic. And I think they have a different pathophysiology to how they occur, and they don't respond as well to furosemide. Often the best way of managing those non-cardiogenics is, if they're not too bad, oxygen therapy, but if they are very bad, sometimes needing to ventilate them. Yeah, high pressure ventilate them.
And of course, if they're very hypotensive and have signs of forward output failure, you also have to think about cases where is the drug actually getting to the kidneys? I've had a few cases where they just don't respond and they're not producing that urine, but they're extremely hypertensive. So I guess there you will be putting them on some sort of positive inotrope like pimobendan or some other dobutamines and that, just to try and get those, the blood to flow through the kidneys more effectively.
True. I think then on a similar note about getting the medications to where you need them to work, something like a pleural effusion is best drained if it's a large volume, rather than letting the furosemide take effect, because it takes several days probably to kind of get on top of that. Same for ascites, if you're able to remove those large volumes of fluid, they'll make the patient feel more comfortable. And something like ascites, where the bowel becomes edematous because of all that fluid, they may not absorb their medications quite as well. So kind of draining the fluid from the abdomen can be beneficial for absorption of the drugs as well.
And so a very quick response, a very easy one, and they feel a lot better, so much quicker. Oxygenation improves as well when you drain these large volume infusions. But I guess also what we haven't sort of mentioned, maybe just switching to a constant rate infusion, that might also be helpful. And I guess if they're on oral medication, this is a chronic case that's not working as well, and they're getting refractory ascites, because of that absorption of problems, then, you know, you want to consider putting them on a different route. So maybe getting the owners to give subcutaneous furosemide, or we can switch to something like tirasemide, which might have a better availability.
Yeah, that's a good point about availability as well. So the bioavailability of the drugs that we use. So it's very variable with furosemide. It's why sometimes you'll see some dogs and cats that respond really well to having it subcutaneously, intramuscularly, IV. You send them home on the oral form and then they come crashing back in heart failure very quickly. So furosemide has a much wider range of bioavailability. And tirzepatide, for example, is another type of loop diuretic, has a much more kind of unpredictable bioavailability, which is like close to 90% of the drug is absorbed into the system. Whereas with furosemide, it can be anything from sort of 30 up to, I think, 60 or 70% of the drug can get absorbed. So very, very different bioavailability. But also, you know, furosemide is the drug that everyone's familiar with. That said, you know, if we kind of think about tirzepatide and the loop diuretics, there is very good data that drugs like tirzepatide may be, they are equivalent, but maybe superior in terms of outcome to furosemide. So those studies are kind of out there now in the literature as well.
And earlier you briefly touched on the contraindications for using diuretics. Is there anything else that you can think of?
I think so, like contraindication for diuretics. Don't use them if they're not in heart failure. I guess that's a really kind of important one. I've seen a few dogs where they've it's often been like respiratory dogs where they've kind of had signs of tachypnea and dyspnea, and they've been cavaliers, so obviously they've had a heart murmur as well, but they've gone straight on to furosemide and actually they've become very volume depleted. Their heart's become very underfilled, so in kind of relation to how big the ventricle chamber is, the walls then become quite thick in relation to the fluid in the chamber, in the left ventricle chamber. So they end up looking a bit like a cat with HCM, and then they end up with an outflow tract obstruction. So, you know, I've seen dogs that have mimicked a cat with an outflow tract obstruction because we've just volume depleted them. So anything like that, any condition where they're already dehydrated, be careful in those situations. We must kind of be mindful of pericardial effusions as much as you can. It's one of those very difficult ones. You know, I think when you think of pericardial effusions, they behave a bit like Addison's in that there's many clinical signs with something like a pericardial effusion, from as simple as vomiting, diarrhea and a cough, that you wouldn't necessarily jump straight to pericardial effusion, but they are common. They're common in like up to a quarter of dogs will have those signs, that you can overlook it and you may end up treating them erroneously. But importantly, that could make them worse. So if you reduce their circulating volume and they've got tamponade, you know, ineffectively can't fill their heart, and then you give them drugs that will reduce their circulating volume, they can get worse. And other times would be in the patients that have very poor cardiac output or they have cardiogenic shock. You've got to be a bit careful with the doses that you give, because those animals are very sensitive to the circulating volume that they have. And so you don't want to drop the circulating volume quickly or rapidly. So we tend to go little and often to try and avoid that. So for like a dog with DCM or a cat with cardiogenic shock, little and often is usually much better than giving large bolus doses of furosemide. You know, so in the literature, there used to be doses of like 4 to 8 mg/kg as a single dose. And we have really moved away from that in recent years, because actually that's probably going to potentially deteriorate the patient rather than improve them in terms of forward flow and forward cardiac output.
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And I guess also in those very severe pulmonary hypertension cases where the left side is very underfilled, that would be quite a high risk. So if your dog or cat's known to have severe pulmonary hypertension and they come in with breathing difficulties, be just a bit more careful about giving any more or higher doses of diuretics. And I think also we touched on the going down the baseline blood. So if you've got electrolyte depletions, it might be worth just being a bit more cautious about going heavy on your diuretics to avoid those big drops in the potassium and the sodium, as we've discussed. And just an interesting one, I wasn't aware of this when I was preparing this. Some diabetics, I think furosemide increases your glucose levels, which I wasn't actually aware of. And so just being careful with diabetics, because it might increase their insulin doses as well. Go from there. And moving on, is there any drug reactions that we have to be aware of with furosemide, especially if these dogs and the cats are, or dogs are on a lot of other drugs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the probably the best place to look is probably in like the formulary for the drugs that we're going to use. But I think the key ones for us are if we're giving, if we're thinking about our patients with heart disease, if we are adjusting their electrolytes and causing electrolyte disturbances, something like digoxin is very sensitive to changes in electrolytes. So be very careful about doses of digoxin in combination with congestive heart failure treatment. Potentially, you know, if we're giving something that's going to volume deplete a patient, then if we give an ACE inhibitor as well, it may exacerbate hypotension, and you might end up with issues there. So just be mindful of it. We don't tend to worry about it, but we are mindful of it so that we're keeping an eye out for it by potentially checking blood pressure in these patients when they come for review. And then finally, thinking about steroids as well. So steroids will increase your sodium reabsorption. So you're more likely to kind of have an increase in circulating volume steroids. But you're also potentially going to see changes in electrolytes because they will cause wasting of water too. So you may get hypokalemia as well. And then finally, I guess we've got to be a bit more mindful of if you have reduced cardiac function and you've got reduced flow to the bowel, there is that risk of causing, you know, issues with corticosteroids and ulcerations and things as well. So just be mindful of that. And similarly, you know, thinking about non-steroidals and furosemide and the effects on the kidneys. Now, I think I always kind of balance it with if you've got a patient that has congestive heart failure, they're typically older patients, and it's kind of just getting the balance with everything. You know, I don't necessarily withhold non-steroidals in a patient with congestive heart failure, especially if it's a patient that has quite bad orthopedic disease. But in theory, there is a contraindication for it, in that non-steroidals will reduce blood flow and can give you kind of kidney injuries, as we know. And if we add in diuretics, which will cause further reduced flow to the kidneys, we may see an acute kidney injury. So being again aware of that, and making sure the owner's aware of that as well.
That's interesting. And we mentioned a bit about tyrosamide. I know there's a lot of similarities. It's a loop diuretic, similar to furosemide, and that it may be sort of up to 20 times more potent than furosemide. We touched a little bit on bioavailability in that, but are there any sort of precautions that we should be taking with when we use tyrosamide? And really, how are we initiating this if they're really on furosemide? Is there any risks?
So it's been shown, I guess, when we think about tyrosamide, it's often not what people reach for as first line, as we said earlier on. But I think there is some good data that it can be used as a first line drug, and it's as good as furosemide once patients have acute pulmonary edema managed. I tend to, in my kind of practice, we tend to use it as a rescue diuretic. And I think in that setting, it's worked really well for me. And, you know, there is data out there which does say that it's helpful in primary cases as well. I think the key thing is when we give it, is that we are usually swapping from one drug, so it's usually furosemide, over to tyrosamide. And when we do that, we are going at somewhere between a 10th and the 20th of the dose, the total daily dose of furosemide. So if they're on 100 milligrams of furosemide a day, we're going to give them between 5 and 10 milligrams of tyrosamide a day. And it might be that we split that into two doses, morning and night. But again, the studies would suggest that once daily dosing is sufficient. However, because we're tending to use it in the later stage, where these dogs are already refractory to furosemide, often twice daily seems to be more effective for our patients when we're doing it as a rescue diuretic. Whereas as a primary diuretic, I think once daily can be sufficient in the first instance. Key thing is tyrosamide is more potent, so we need to keep an eye on the kidneys. We tend to suggest having bloods repeated about 5 days after starting treatment. And if you do have a patient and it's a drug that you've not used before, give us a call, give us a lowdown on the case that you have, and we can help you to make that transition. Partly because I think when you get to that point, you're often later on in the treatment of heart failure. And if you can't get the congestion under control in a reasonable time frame, it might be the owners decide to call it a day. And it may be it was just that the dose needed adjusting. So, you know, I think the doses in the on the data sheet are probably for your first, your first episode of congestive heart failure. When you're using it as a rescue diuretic, we're often going at the much higher levels than it would say on the data sheet.
Great. Moving on to pimobendan. Obviously, this is a very widely used drug in cardiac disease, and we see a lot of cases where clients haven't agreed to a workup, and then vets are putting them on the pimobendan. Can we actually do much harm with pimobendan? And what are these risks?
Yeah, can we do harm with pimobendan? There are some cases that will get worse with pimobendan. So, you know, I would say if you have the case that gets erroneously diagnosed with heart failure and you give them furosemide and you reduce their circulating volume and then you give them pimobendan and you increase their contractility, we can cause those animals to develop outflow tract obstructions when they didn't have one before. And I've seen that with a number of patients where we've treated them and they've not needed therapy, and we've had to take them off that therapy that they've come in on because it's causing a part of the problem. I think the main kind of indications when we are going to use it is in preclinical mitral valve disease when they are stage B2. So that's to say that they have a left atrium and a left ventricle that is greater than the reference intervals that we use. So that's an LAAO of over 1.6 and an LVIDDN. So that's left ventricular internal dimension in diastole, normalized to the body weight of more than 1.7. So that's the very good, very clear cutoffs for using it in dogs with mitral valve disease. We have data for using it in Dobermans as well. So there's some very clear cut values in Dobermans, which I cannot remember off the top of my head. And I have on a piece of paper next to our ultrasound machine. And then anything outside of those, there is no data, no good data for dogs. But we will use it in cases like mitral valve dysplasia. And we will use it in animals that develop systolic dysfunction, like, for example, from a tachycardia induced cardiomyopathy. We would use it as if they had DCM. So we do extrapolate from what the license is for the medication. Now, one thing is when they're preclinical with mitral valve disease, there is an indication to use the medication, but it should just be carried on when they go into congestive heart failure. The key is not to give it too early, though. So not to give it for our B1 patients. So those are the patients that have mild mitral valve disease that don't necessarily have significant left atrial or left ventricular dilation. And that's because only about a third of dogs will ever go from that stage, this early mitral valve stage, to the later mitral valve stage of dilation. So if we treated every dog that we heard with a murmur, every old dog breed that had a heart murmur, we would probably find that we're over-treating two-thirds of the population of dogs with mitral valve disease. So it's a massive number of dogs that would be on medications that didn't need it. So you kind of really need the scan to get the information that you need to decide whether to treat them or not.
So I read once that it was about 50% of dogs with a grade 3 murmur will only be a B2 stage. So you may be treating, even if you're just listening to a murmur,
yeah,
you may be treating animals, 50% of the animals, without actually having a murmur. And of course, this is going to have a cost implication for these owners because, you know, this is a very slow progressing disease. And it can take many years before they go from a B1 to a B2. So they could be on treatment for 2-3 years before, and that's a cost implication for the clients.
Exactly. A client comes and said the pimobendan is working really well, and it's an old Jack Russell, and it's been on pimobendan for 6 years. And you know, you look at that dog, and you probably think just from the history, that dog probably was B1 and probably still is B1, even now 6 years later. They're one of those breeds, aren't they, the Jack Russells, where very few of them, you know, some do, but very few of them end up in congestive heart failure. Most of them just pootle along with mitral valve B1 for the whole of their life, and wouldn't necessarily need to be on pimobendan. But you're right, the murmur grades is a really good point as well. So a grade 3 murmur, only 50% of dogs with a grade 3 murmur will be B1, and 50% will be B2. So we see very few dogs with a grade 3 murmur. If it's a small breed dog with mitral valve disease, it's almost 0% of dogs with a grade 3 murmur will be in congestive heart failure. So I think that's a good take home message, actually, that a grade 3 murmur is the chance for us to start investigating the patient. But at a grade 3 murmur in a small breed dog, it's unlikely that dog has congestive heart failure. And so probably thinking we need to do more than an echo, probably also radiograph the dog if there are clinical signs of tachypnea and dyspnea.
Is there any contraindications for using pimobendan?
Yeah, I think the big contraindications are usually where you have an outflow tract obstruction. So if you increase the force of contractility and you have an outflow tract obstruction, you actually increase the wall stress on the heart. And that can be detrimental for the heart and for remodeling. So we would avoid using it where you have an outflow tract obstruction like pulmonic stenosis and aortic stenosis. Sometimes you'll see patients get referred to us and they end up with kind of more of a myocardial failure from those conditions. So they get such severe aortic stenosis stenosis or severe pulmonic stenosis that we may end up sending them home on pimobendan, but that's very much the minority. There's probably not a, you know, there's a contraindication really if you have an outflow tract obstruction. And the same too for HCM in cats. So in cats with HCM, there was at one point a real move towards putting cats with HCM either preclinical or clinical with heart failure onto pimobendan. And actually that's really kind of recently with a recent prospective study, we now no longer see a survival advantage for giving pimobendan to cats. So we don't tend to medicate cats with pimobendan, except if they have very severe systolic dysfunction. So severe systolic dysfunction where or regional wall hypokinesis. So like, you know, almost looks like they've had a bit of a heart attack, if you like, a myocardial infarction to an area of the heart.
Yeah, that's interesting. And any drug reactions that you can have with pimobendan?
I think very few. I mean, the ones that we see on an occasional basis are changes in appetite, vomiting and diarrhea, so kind of GI signs with it. And it's best to give it on an empty stomach, because actually, if you give it with food, they won't get as much absorption of the medication. So importantly, to give it on an empty stomach. And then finally, if you give drugs that reduce contractility, well, pimobendan increases contractility. So if you're giving a beta blocker, for example, and then you give pimobendan, you're kind of giving with one hand and taking away with the other. So just being aware of that, that you're going to reduce the effects of pimobendan if you're giving a beta blocker or calcium channel blocker as well.
So I guess the take-home message for pimobendan really is ideally get a heart scan done if possible, just in case, because like you say, aortic stenosis, pulmonic stenosis have murmurs. So just listening to a sort of an animal, you can't just assume it's going to all be mitral valve disease. So best to just try and get an echo done. I think moving on to spironolactone, we use this quite a lot, often in conjunction with ACE inhibitors, and we know it's a weak diuretic, but it has some other sort of effects, antifibrotic effects and so on. Are there any side effects with the use in spironolactone?
So I think in terms of managing heart failure, very few. In theory, if you're giving an ACE inhibitor and spironolactone, there's the potential for seeing high levels of potassium. Clinically, in the patients that we manage, most of those patients are also on furosemide. So I think it's very rare that we would ever see a patient that became hyperkalemic if we were treating them with a furosemide and an ACE inhibitor and spironolactone, I should say, as well. But I think spironolactone, when you think of spironolactone and ACE inhibitors, kind of think of them as like the marathon runners of managing heart failure. You know, you've got your furosemide, which is like the sprinter that you need from the very start to get things going. And then you carry that one on, it carries on all the way through. But spironolactone and ACE inhibitors tend to be the effects of them or the benefits of them tend to take a while for you to see them. So they're not going to kind of change things overnight. But we can see side effects. We will always, as part of our congestive heart failure care, they'll always go on spironolactone here at Paragon. But there are some things to be aware of. So one is in entire male dogs that you can get prostatic problems. You can actually get atrophy of the prostate and changes to reproductive ability. And rarely does it ever come up, because you think, God, a dog that's in heart failure, that's got atrial fibrillation and DCM, probably shouldn't be trying to get its leg over. But if it is, and it's on spironolactone, it might be that there's a failure in sperm quality and changes to prostate secretion as well. So just probably important to know that if you have a breeding dog, although if it's on heart failure meds, it probably shouldn't be being bred from. And then finally for cats, so it's been shown in Maine Coons, and occasionally we might see it sporadically in other breeds as well, but it can cause severe ulcerative dermatitis around the face. So you may sort of see that intense itching and pouring at the face with spironolactone. So if you see that in a cat, stop the medication and it tends to settle. It's something that gets reported from time to time, but I haven't had a really bad episode of one of those.
Was it
a Maine Coon?
No, I think it was something else, but I can't remember. It was a very long time ago, but it just broke out in all these ulcers all over its face after, I think, a week after starting Cardella. So I think I would say that may have been the cause, but we withdrew it and the ulcers cleared up. So it was interesting. And contraindications, is there any contraindications?
Well, I think When you think about the possibility of it causing hyperkalemia, and if you're using it in patients that might have hypotassium to start with, so potentially an Addison's patient or an animal with urinary tract obstructions, for example, those might be considerations. In patients where they have low sodium to start with, being mindful in those patients, that can be a contraindication if the sodium is very low. And then also with pregnancy and lactation as well.
Interesting. And drug reactions, I think we again touched on a few.
Yeah, mostly it's going to be related to the electrolyte changes. So spironolactone is a really good drug for reducing fibrosis in the heart. And in human studies, it's been shown to improve survival for people that have heart failure that are on spironolactone. And a similar study was done in dogs with mitral valve disease and suggested similar types of effects in dogs. Which is why we use it, and there's some good safety data in cats for its use as well. The times that we might see issues is if we combine it with other drugs that affect your electrolytes. So other diuretics such as the loop diuretics, so furosemide and tirasemide, possibly seeing it with the thiazide, so kind of one of the other types of diuretics that we'll sometimes use. Maybe you'll see it if you've got a patient that's already on a potassium supplement and you give them more, you give them an increase in spironolactone, so you kind of have this aldosterone antagonist effect, you might see an increase in potassium then as well. Again, I've not really seen it, but it's a potential theoretical risk. And then finally with digoxin, so if we have digoxin, we may see plasma levels of the drug increase when they're on spironolactone. So if you have a dog and you're treating it for atrial fibrillation and it's already on spironolactone, that may affect the dose that we give, it may affect the amount of digoxin in the bloodstream, I should say.
Interesting. So I guess the precautions is just really monitoring your electrolytes and your renal values, like we've discussed with your diuretics. And then I think finally, ACE inhibitors, the big one. We often use ACE inhibitors combined with spironolactone, or sometimes just on their own. Are these, what are the side effects using ACE inhibitors?
So I think the key for when we're using them here, and I don't know, like this is what something I've always done, is they've never been talking about them being one of the marathon runners. They don't start the race at the beginning. So they start once the sprints have all gone. So I don't use the ACE inhibitors until we've got good management of congestive heart failure, so that we have reduced the dose of the diuretics. We've checked the kidneys to make sure the kidneys are okay. We've assessed blood pressure. And so generally when I'm adding an ACE inhibitor in, and also spironolactone, because I tend to give them as a combination pill, when I add that drug in, I tend to do that once I'm happy the animal is stable and is eating well and drinking well, because I think if you add it in and they're hypotensive, or you're affecting kind of flow to the kidneys with the ACE inhibitors, you may end up with an acute kidney injury in the acute phase if you put it in when you're managing acute congestive heart failure. So generally it'll be a week or so before I would start that as a treatment. In cats with heart failure, the benefit for ACE inhibitors is very limited. The kind of the data at the moment will suggest there is probably no benefit for giving an ACE inhibitor to a cat with preclinical or clinical heart failure. Should I say again, preclinical HCM or clinical HCM, so cats with HCM and heart failure. So we don't use ACE inhibitors in cats, and I think kind of the literature would support that as a plan for a cat. But equally, who wants to be giving cats more medications than you have to, because they're generally a little bit more tricky to medicate than a dog. So most of the time we won't be using ACE inhibitors in cats. If the patients are hypotensive or they're already showing signs of poor cardiac output, just be careful about the dose and keep an eye on blood pressure as well.
And I guess also start, if they are mildly hypertensive or weak to start off with, sometimes you just want to stabilize them first before starting it. You may go in with a lower dose and see how they tolerate it before, rather than going in on the full dose.
Find that a lot with cats, don't we? That the cats that come in heart failure, they have they're hypertensive at the very beginning, and then you treat them for the congestive heart failure and the hypertension improves. And that's sort of something that you need to keep an eye on in the hypertensive patients. If they remain hypotensive with poor function, maybe we consider medicating with more than just furosemide in a cat. But most of the time, there's probably not a good reason for ACE inhibitors in cats, probably at this stage in what we know and what the literature would suggest.
So I guess starting them as well when they're stable and eating well is I don't tend to add it in until they're eating better, because often they're not eating when they come in. Is there any drug reactions?
So one of the big ones, theoretical ones, is the risk of hyperkalemia. As we said, spironolactone. You can give spironolactone and ACE inhibitor together in a combined pill. And there is this theoretical risk of hyperkalemia. But most of the patients that will go on to a combination of ACE inhibitor and spironolactone will be patients that are in congestive heart failure. So they're having medications, furosemide, that will reduce their electrolytes anyway. So we don't tend to see it as a clinical issue. And we don't use ACE inhibitors for preclinical heart disease or for many preclinical heart disease, because there's not a good indication for them. So I think it's a risk and probably show it probably was shown in experimental models more so, where these animals don't have, aren't in heart failure, don't have furosemide on board already, that maybe those ones would be at risk of that. But we don't really see that, I don't think, as a clinical issue. But if you have an animal that has renal injury, kidney disease, might be already on non-steroidals, may not be on non-steroidals if they've got kidney disease, but if they've already got kidney issues, adding an ACE inhibitor can worsen those. So make sure you keep an eye on the renal values and monitor those very closely. And then a last kind of recommendation, again, partly because of changes to blood pressure, is we tend to sort of stop an ACE inhibitor 24 hours before surgery, so that we don't kind of exacerbate hypotension under GA.
Interesting. So I guess just to round it up, the precautions are the same as before, really, getting blood pressure, renal electrolyte values, and maybe a urine sample, just because it's very difficult to diagnose renal disease after you've started all this medications. But just monitor the values and adjust treatments accordingly.
Must be honest, that the SG, I don't tend to do an SG in most of my dogs that go into heart failure. I often feel like I put the furosemide in, and then once the furosemide is on board, they're always going to have a dilute urine. So I think that's one thing we'll sometimes see as well, is that the labs will report that the SG is low, and it may be an indicator of heart disease. And then you think, actually, well, they're on furosemide, so they're going to have a low SG. We can't purely rely on that. So the key would be, is if you're going to do that, is to kind of get one pre-diuretic.
That's what I thought. It just helps you to understand what the kidney function's like in these cases before you start it. So ideally try get a urine sample. I guess that's it. It rounds up the side effects and everything on the more common cardiac diseases. It's been very interesting. I hope it's been a helpful podcast for you, everyone.
Yeah, and if you have any cases that you need help with, any patients where it's a question of are they in heart failure or not, or you need some help with medications, or you want to swap a patient onto tirasemide or discuss some of the nuances of our podcast, then please do get in touch with us. We'd be only too happy to hear from you.
Hey, thank you very much.
Thank you.